make fun of now. It's not.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
you know, it's like you say, "Well, we need a moral leader." Like, yeah, get out of here. What are you talking about? You know.
Yeah.
Whereas in Islam, the whole point of a leader is that he is the moral compass.
Exactly, because we have to live up to the standards of the Sharia,
and Quran, and try to live according to the way, you know, Allah wants us to. So we need absolutely. A person who himself
is a model,
is a moral embodiment of that.
Yeah.
So this is the difference when we talk about, for example, in Shiism, we insisting on the imams. An imam means, you know, leader.
It
means leader. It literally means leader. When we insist on the imams being the leaders of Islam, as opposed to, you know, the khalifas or whatever other views there were, it's because they were not only, they were also the embodiments of those values of Islam that they were trying to
impose.
So it wasn't, didn't have this problem of people talking about Islam, but they themselves being, you know, unjust people.
That's a very good point that you're raising.
And it's an ayah in the Quran.
Yes.
It talks about, you know, those who enjoin others or those who command others to justice, and they are just themselves.
To do good, to do righteousness. That's
and they
right.
are just themselves.
Yeah. Yes.
This is the difference.
This is the contradiction, isn't it? Because this is the crisis that we're really talking about in the West, that the leaders who, you know, espouse human rights and who, you know, give all kinds of niceties or pleasantries about all sorts of things, but
things that nobody would disagree with.
Nobody would disagree, but they don't live up to those.
Well, personal, of course not.
In their personal not only and do they private not live life, up to the they're as corrupt and rotten to the core.
Right. It's not only that they don't live up to it; it's exactly the opposite.
It's sheer hypocrisy.
Right. They talk about, you know, human rights and human dignity, and they go around killing people around the world.
Exactly.
What I'm trying to say is that this goes back to moral character. Things like moral character, things like an ethical life.
Sure.
Things like, you know, having a personal ethical standard for yourself, which, again, it's not even so much that they don't, it's beyond the fact that they don't have it anymore. It's like something that you make fun of now. Mm. Whereas in Islam, and, you know, alhamdulillah, thank God we have Walayat Faqih. Mm. Thank God we have Walayat Faqih.
Thanks to the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and it really, if anybody doubts this, they should come to Iran and they should see it themselves, what a positive effect this has. Whether it's in terms of, you know, keeping the ship, you know, on course,
yes.
And whether it's on the left or on the right, trying to, you know, go to either extreme, you have that leadership. Whether it's about, you know, raising those basic issues in society and pointing out those problems if the governments are not doing their job, or if certain things that are going amiss is mentioned by the Supreme Leader, or whether it's encouraging certain things. I'll give you a very clear example.
Please.
If you look at the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, during his tenure and during the time that he's been the Supreme Leader, his focus has been on and the thing that he's been, you know, constantly talking about and making a priority is scientific advancement.
Exactly.
And knowledge and building a scientific society in terms of having, you know, Iran advance when it comes to all sorts of knowledge, whether it's technical and scientific in terms of the hard sciences or whether it's, you know, humanities or whatever subjects there are.
Yeah, whatever fields there are. Yeah, absolutely.
And you see an incredible thing happening in these 20 years in Iran, which is you have a country which is very backward, you know, 40 years ago in terms of science, doesn't have its own, you know, scientific life really. It's just a place where theories, you know, developed other places are imitated. Or worse, where, you know, when it comes to technical things, and you're an engineer.
Yes.
You know, bringing in foreign engineers.
Thank you for reminding me.
Bringing in foreign engineers to do very simple tasks.
That's right.
So we have this massive transformation happening in Iran because it is insisted upon by the leader. Mm. And it is insisted in the sense that he says that when the governments come and whoever is going to come, and it doesn't matter from which side of the political spectrum, and, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, who it is, a priority has to be the scientific advancement of the society. And we see incredible advancements.
Of course.
Things that are acknowledged by the different, you know, non-governmental organizations which, you know, are working in this field globally, which have nothing to do with Iran, and, you know, there's no need for them to try to... talking about this, how advanced Iran has become. So this is one example of when you have a leadership that comes and says to whoever is the government, it's fine, you do those things that you promised and the things that you...
Yeah, to run the affairs
of
the
state. But
these
things have to be set in society.
Sorry.
I'll give you another example. The idea of taking care of the poor and the weak.
You know, we're talking about welfare.
You know, we have this thing in the West where, you know, it's just become, I mean, this is goes back to Thatcher and Reagan. And,
oh, of course it does.
You know, these guys that they're like, oh, you know, you don't want to take care of the poor anymore.
No.
Or you don't care about the poor anymore. Or it's their fault that they're poor.
Yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, of course there's been abuse of the welfare system and so on. We're not denying that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the basic idea that you would help the weaker members
of society. And that's a measure of civilization,
like, you know, elderly people who worked their whole life, who are maybe now not capable of working that much.
Right.
You know, we're
right.
not talking
and
about people.
And they're entitled to
certain
rights and
certain
benefits.
Yeah, we're not talking about people who are you know, just lazy bums who are not doing anything. We're talking about people who work 30, 40, 50 years.
And they're entitled to something at the end of the day.
You got to take care of them.
Yes.
We're talking about people who are maybe physically disabled or who are mentally disabled. We know, we're not talking about, you know, so these are things that in a society which has a moral leadership,
sure,
which has a leader that bases his you know, actions and his speeches and the way he guides society on a certain set ethical moral framework,
sure,
these things are not going to be put aside
in
a society because somebody got the vote and, you know, they're going to come in and they're going to change everything, you know, from top to bottom and whatever. So, you know, this is what we're talking about.
Mm.
We're talking about that there are certain things in every society, whether you're talking about the, you know, Islamic society or in the East or in the West or in Europe, that require a moral leader to maintain it.
Yes.
To safeguard it.
Mm.
To not allow those dynamics that happen in every society
to decline or to be.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is one of the great values.
Mm.
I would also like to point out this. This is something that some of the, you know, even Western experts talk about, which is that when you have a leadership, as you have in the West, which is so a result, a derivative, a consequence of money and moneyed interests and special interests, well, that's not really a leadership. You know, you don't have honest leadership.
No.
You know what I mean?
Or visionary leadership.
Right. You don't have a person taking chances. You don't have a person, as you were saying very correctly, you know, presenting a vision.
Yeah.
It's always tactics. It's always politics. How are we going to get to the next election?
It's the short term now.
Right. How are we going to get to the next elections?
Mm.
How is this going to play out in the media?
Yeah.
How is this going to work out, you know, with Congress?
With the greatest profitability for my backers or my supporters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or my party or whatever.
Or my party, yes.
Whereas if you have a leadership like Welat Fakih, which is above these matters.
Exactly.
Which is what some of the people, when they talk about the king having a royal system, you know, like those who advocate constitutional monarchy.
Constitutional,
you know, like
monarchy,
in Britain or in some of the Western European
and
countries.
And we still haven't got a constitution.
Right.
Here we are.
The problem with that and the difference is this. Yes, I agree in principle that a good king can have that function in a society.
He does, yes.
Or
that's
a queen,
true.
Right?
That's true.
But unfortunately what we see is that these kings and queens are not really... they're because they're... you see, this is the difference between having a religious leadership...
Based on merit.
On merit. A scholar, a faqih, somebody who has...
qualified for
that. Who has struggled themselves to get to this both intellectual and academic position and also moral and spiritual position, because this is a moral and spiritual, you have to have that level of it as well in order to be able to guide a society.
Right.
You know, you can't just be some, you know, whatever, you know, guy that just comes along and gets the votes and okay, well, I'm going to be the moral leader now. You know, you have to work on yourself, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
And again, age is also maybe not necessarily, it doesn't have to be an old person. It could be like, you know, Supreme
Berlusconi wouldn't qualify.
Right, exactly. You know what I mean? I mean, I'll give you an example. You know, this new Pope Francis, you know, he's saying good things.
Yes.
You know, he's saying nice things.
Yeah.
We like what he's saying, you know, about the poor and helping the poor and, you know,
bringing those
not being so, you know, ostentatious, the church not being so ostentatious and so on. I mean, we have issues when it comes to celibacy and...
other issues.
There are other issues.
Yeah, yes, true.
But, you know, this is what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
I'm talking about somebody who was a little bit above this, who was above the fray.
Yes.
Okay? The kings were supposed to do that. The queens were supposed to do that.
To do that.
Well, they're not doing that.
No.
They basically become, you know, these rich elites that, you know...
Exactly. They're part and parcel
running
of the
around
same game.
On the jet set and, you know, going on ski vacations and going
That's
on Caribbean
right.
vacations.
And costing the taxpayer enormous amount of
money. So these are not, you know, in principle, when those that defend monarchy in those countries or constitutional monarchy, when they talk about that, yes, the principle is correct that you would have somebody above the fray. But what we see historically is that none of that has happened.
No.
When was the last time you had a king who was morally you know,
yeah,
leading the country.
Sure.
And you know, setting.
Well, I can't recall one. Put it that way. Yes.
Right. I mean, maybe 100 years ago, 200 years ago, something. But
something,
you know,
maybe down the line. Right. Yes.
And again, the difference is that when you have a royal system that's based on, you know, hereditary.
Yes.
Monarchy,
yeah.
You know, which is a kind of a lottery, right?
Yes.
We always talk about that.
That's right, yes, right, yes.
You know, a certain kind of lottery, you know, depending on, you know, who, you know, your father and your mother.
Yes, Prince Charles still weeps.
Right,
yes.
So, you know, these are things that obviously are going to affect that leadership, as opposed to, you know, as you were explaining, a system in which a person is chosen based on their own merits to
on
be
their
the
own merits.
And
yes.
Remember, the supreme leader is somebody that comes and is chosen. It's an indirect election.
Yes,
the people elect the assembly of experts,
and the experts
and the assembly of experts, you know, appoint, select a supreme leader.
Supreme leader,
and they're able to, you know. Which you can't. I mean, with a king, what are you going to do? You can't impeach a king, right?
No, you can't. Yes, I remember that since Charles the First.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So you know, this is a problem with having kings. Is, you know, once you got them, you got them. I mean,
you got them. Yes. How long get rid of them until death do us part?
How long has Elizabeth been around? I mean,
oh, she's been around for a long time. You know, this is why Charles weeps. You know, he really cries. You know, he wants mother off that throne as soon as possible.
Right.
You know.
So, you know, this is what we're talking about. We haven't even mentioned places like, you know, Saudi Arabia. We haven't mentioned places.
Yeah. It's our favorite topic. But
you know, we haven't mentioned, you know, some of these, you know, hereditary
kings, are they?
We haven't mentioned, like, Azerbaijan hereditary presidents.
Their hereditary line doesn't go that far
right.
back.
So I would categorize them. I mean, obviously, Saudi Arabia is a monarchy, but I mean, I would categorize, you know, it's the same principle that we're talking about.
Exactly. That's true.
But the unfortunate thing is that you have in the West a society and a civilization which actually did value moral leadership at some point.
At some point, that's true.
You know, where you have examples of that in its history where you really had people. And, of course, you have it in the East as well. You have it, you know, we were talking about one of the khalifas, which was, you know, Omar bin Abdul Aziz, who was considered one of the good khalifas. You know, this is something that's really apparent in the West now.
I think so.
If you look at...
I think this crisis has reached rock bottom, as they say, you know.
Yeah, and it has to do with the rise of basically this complete plutocracy, this kind of complete...
The rule of the wealth.
Exactly, and rule of money, and this kind of domination of the whole system by money.
Money, by banks.
And special interests.
Yes, special interests, yes.
And when we're talking about special interests, obviously when we talk about, you know, money, Zionism is right there.
Well, I mean, it's right there. I mean, they're all... They've all got those names, haven't they? You know,
I
don't want to go into that.
Right. What I'm trying to say is that this doesn't
Lehman, you know.
Right. What I'm trying to say is that this is together. You know, the fact that you would have a large, huge nation like the United States, 300 million people, not being able to pursue its own interests in the Middle East because of Israel or because of Al Saud.
Yes.
And again, we've talked about this many times, but it bears repeating, which is that, you know, it would be in the interests of the American people
to do something in the interest of America.
To have good relations with Iran, for example.
Well,
you know,
that would
to
be
actually,
nice.
You know, say, you know what, let's bury the hatchet, you know, let's start it. You know, we recognize that you had a revolution, you know, fine, you kicked the, you know, our guy out. That's okay.
Yes.
It's ancient history, as the Americans say, you know.
Sure.
You know, let's get on with it.
Let bygones be bygones.
Let's get on with it,
yeah.
You know. And so, you know, that would be in the interests of the American people. It would be in the interests of even the American elites.
Sure.
But, unfortunately, you have, you know, the Israel lobby. You have the Saudi lobby, which doesn't allow American elites to make that move.
Well, the other thing...
And they don't have the courage to tell, you know, foreigners,
like the Israelis or the Saudis,
back off, this is our national interest.
Sure, but their short-term interests are in congruence with each other, aren't they? Because
exactly.
Absolutely
correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's the key point, which you were pointing out, which is that this is why the leadership can't do it, because they're only thinking short-term.
Yes.
They're thinking next elections. They're thinking Congress. They're thinking, you know...
My pocket, basically.
Right.
Yes.
You know, how are we going to get the funding? They're thinking, you know, media campaign. What's Fox News going to say? What's MSNBC going to say?
Exactly. It's all about image and so many other things.
Right, which is why we mentioned the example of Nixon.
That's right.
You know, Nixon, being a conservative Republican anti-communist...
Sure.
You know, gets up and goes to communist China.
Yeah.
and says, you know what, we're not going to recognize Taiwan, sure, the nationalist Chinese government any longer. Mm. You know, it's a little island with a couple million versus, yes, you know, this massive
continent. Right. Yes,
yes, it's true. Mm. It helped the Americans in fighting the Soviets and, yes, creating a tripolar situation.
Sure.
In order to pit the Chinese against the Soviets. But still, you know, here you had a guy who you would not expect to have been friendly with communists in communist China.
Sure. But he was basically doing it in the American interest.
But he realized that this is in the American interest. And he stood up against the people in his own party.
Of course, who were deadly against it.
Right. Yeah. So this is what we talk about when we talk about leadership. Okay, you can call it, I don't know if I would call that moral leadership, what Nixon did, but it was more
visionary.
It was a kind of leadership.
Yes, yes.
You know what I mean?
Better than George Bush Jr. Right. You know? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Or if you look at somebody, I mean, look, I'm trying to, you know, just bring examples. There's a lot of, you can, you know, make a lot of complaints about these examples. But you have somebody like Lyndon Johnson, you know, yes, who's from Texas, from the South. He's a Southern white, you know, growing up in that segregation environment. And yet he stands up for civil rights.
He was hands up for civil rights,
right.
Yes.
So, you know, these are things that, and again, it might have not been easy for him to do that.
Just in the last minute or so, Dr. Turabi, just sum up for us, really, you know, this crisis of leadership in the West.
Well, it's to sum it up, it's very simple.
Yes.
You have a system which is an Islamic system versus a secular system.
That's true.
In Islam, we say that the leader of a society has to himself be a moral person.
That's right.
Has to be a just person themselves in their own lives.
That's right. Okay. Personally, they must reflect that.
This is the difference. Mm. In secularism, they say if he is, that's good.
That's good.
But
that's
if he
bonus.
Isn't, yeah. But if he isn't, doesn't, if he isn't, he is.
Right.
That's basically what the difference is.
Sure.
You have a leadership system being presented in Islam in the time when the Prophet, peace be upon him, and the Imams are not present, which is the Walayat Faqih, the leadership of the
jurisprudent,
who is the one that is able to guide society as an expert in law. And law in Islam is not the law of the West. Law is a manifestation of divine right and wrong. Okay, in Islam, when we talk about Sharia, when we talk about laws, fiqh, faqih, this is a manifestation of what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is bad, as defined by the Creator. So we need a person who is there to guide society on this path.
Sure. Thank you very much, Dr. Mahdi Turabi, for your valuable contribution on the program today. It certainly enlightened us a lot about what is the reality of the crisis of leadership in the West. And thanks very much for that. And it just leaves me to say for our audience, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you very much for listening to our program today. Goodbye.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo Jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In another sign of growing tensions and ties between Washington and Beijing, the United States Central Intelligence Agency announced the formation of a group that would focus exclusively on China. The CIA argued in a statement that the China Mission Center aims at addressing what it called global challenges to the U.S. competitiveness posed by the People's Republic of China. According to the U.S. spy agency, those issues include emerging technologies, economic security, climate change, and health.
The real threat that China poses that the United States is referring to is the ability to undermine the empire. And when we see that right now, that there's definitely a global shift going on, which is starting to move from the West towards the East, of which China is the main power in this situation.
The announcement comes amid a wider prioritization by the administration of President Joe Biden on countering Beijing. In June, Biden announced a new task force at the Pentagon to assess and respond to Beijing's military challenge. The United States and China remain at odds over several issues, including the situation in Hong Kong, U.S. relations with Taiwan, trade, commerce, and a disputed South China Sea. U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In the case of China, however, it appears that he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing. Top U.S. counterintelligence officials have reportedly warned that a concerning number of CIA informants are being captured and executed. According to the New York Times, the warning came in a top-secret memo the officials issued to all of the CIA stations and bases around the world last week. The memo suggests that the agency's Counterintelligence Mission Center looked at dozens of cases in the last several years involving foreign informants who had been killed, arrested, or most likely compromised. The cable itself was not necessarily unique, but as the Times notes, announcing the specific number of killings is rare, as the information is usually kept strictly under wraps by intelligence officials.
And this has been something that was significant enough that it was leaked into the mainstream media where it was reported on. It seems the United States sees this as possibly a potential crisis and something they need to reinforce with more bodies.
According to the Times, recruiting spies has always been highly risky. However, the cable warned that the CIA has not excelled in the area recently for reasons that include being too trusting of sources, underestimating foreign intelligence agencies, and moving too quickly to recruit informants while ignoring potential risks.
It's frankly acknowledged that everybody is spying on everybody else because everybody needs to know what their competitor is doing with regards to their stance towards them and what plans they have, etc. So in this regards, the United States is not doing anything new, nothing that it has ever done before. But the main bulwark of this, the main reason this is happening, is the U.S. is trying to expand its current intelligence network.
The report says that the uptick in the compromised informants highlights the growing prowess of other countries in employing innovations like biometric scans, facial recognition, artificial intelligence, and hacking tools to track the movements of CIA officers in order to discover the sources. The memo suggested that the U.S. spy agency overestimated its capacities and underestimated its adversaries. The results show that countries targeted by U.S. espionage are becoming more capable of exposing agents than ever before.
U.S. social media giant has come under scathing attack by former employee. The company has been accused of putting profit over everything else. Former Facebook employee Frances Hogan says that the company's sites and apps are harmful for children. She's also accused the social media platform of stoking divisions in society. 37-year-old Hogan was previously a product manager at the company. Now she's a whistleblower and has turned against Facebook. She made the accusation at a hearing in the Senate. Hogan accused Facebook of putting profit over safety and compared it to tobacco companies, arguing that a company with such frightening influence over so many people, over their deepest thoughts, feelings, and behavior, needs real oversight. She also said that if left alone, Facebook will continue to make choices that go against the common good.
If you look at the way that they filter content, if you look at the way that they censor certain topics that they'd rather not be seen, the way that they quote-unquote fact-check some of the things, the way that they delete accounts without discretion, the way that they censor people, and the way that they choose what content goes at the top of your newsfeed or shows up on your newsfeed at all through their algorithm, they really have a grip on what it is we are able to see on Facebook.
The context for the hearing were materials that she had leaked to the Wall Street Journal. According to the documents, Facebook's own studies suggest that Instagram and social media in general have a negative psychological effect on young girls. She also accused Facebook's CEO Zuckerberg of having too much power and bringing up the January 6th Capitol riot.
Facebook wants you to believe that the problems we're talking about are unsolvable. They want you to believe in false choices. They want you to believe that you must choose between a Facebook full of divisive and extreme content or losing one of the most important values our country was founded upon, free speech. That you must choose between public oversight of Facebook's choices and your personal privacy. That to be able to share fun photos of your kids with old friends, you must also be inundated with anger-driven virality. They want you to believe that this is just part of the deal.
Facebook has faced growing scrutiny and increasing calls for its regulation. Founder Mark Zuckerberg hit back, saying the latest accusations were at odds with the company's goals. In a letter to the staff, he said that many of the claims were illogical and pointed to Facebook's efforts to fight harmful content. The CEO argued that while Facebook took the initiative to create a massive research project to identify and solve certain problems, critics are merely weaponizing that work against the company to create a false narrative. Responding to Hogan's claims that Facebook's attempts to limit harmful content were constantly hampered by a shortage of staff, he said, "If we did not care about fighting harmful content, then why would we employ so many more people dedicated to this than any other company in our space, even ones larger than us?" Facebook is the world's most popular social media site. The company says it has 2.7 billion monthly active users.
So I think overall it's very detrimental to democracy because of the flow of information that is so tightly controlled through Facebook. And also think it shows, much like tobacco companies in the past or vape companies, that they've targeted children who are in very crucial developmental stages in their lives in order to get new customers, as noted in the testimony before the Senate.
Hundreds of millions of people also use the company's other products, including WhatsApp and Instagram. But it has been criticized on several fronts, from failing to protect users' privacy to not doing enough to halt the spread of disinformation.
Facebook, as I said, can truly decide what shows up in your newsfeed, what gets attention, what is put in the spotlight, and what is suppressed. And I think that's a big problem. It doesn't matter who you're friends with or who you like or the groups you're in, etc. They can filter stuff out through including certain ads. They can bury stuff in their algorithms. They can ban or censor or suspend accounts that may or may not go against the terms of service. Sometimes it's not so clear whether or not certain users go against terms of service but find themselves banned or suspended anyway.
The accusations against the social media giant came amid a worldwide outage of the company's platforms. The social media services went down for almost 6 hours, impacting more than 3.5 billion users worldwide. The global outage and the revelations seriously harmed the media giant's status in the world as a reliable media platform.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, led by the United States, has long been on a confrontational course with Russia. Developments on the ground on Russia's western borders and elsewhere are pointing to increasing tensions between the two sides. The Western Alliance has been moving military hardware and ground forces to Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. The situation in Ukraine has turned into another serious bone of contention. NATO and Russia have been flexing their military muscles. The two have shown through their military drills and deployments, as well as public statements, that they are serious about pursuing their geopolitical interests in the Baltic region, the Middle East, and even in the Arctic. Meanwhile, America's ongoing efforts to complete a comprehensive missile system in Europe have further worried Moscow. Radars, warships, and long-range missile interceptors placed across Europe form components of the controversial system.
Without the Soviet Union, NATO does not need to exist, and they are clinging for dear life. They're trying to justify to create a reason for them to be there and to continue to exist. And that's why they're constantly provoking Russia when Russia is not the Soviet Union. They are not the threat that the Soviet Union was.
As NATO expands eastward, Russia is not sitting idly by. It has adopted a set of countermeasures. For instance, Russia has used its westernmost territory, Kaliningrad, as a platform to boost its defenses. The territory is located between Poland and Lithuania on the Baltic Sea. Moscow has deployed the Iskander missiles and its S-400 air defense systems in Kaliningrad. NATO and Moscow have maintained contacts to try to minimize risks. The Russian Federation has had an observer mission to the Western Alliance. It was meant to promote cooperation in common security areas. This week, tensions between the two sides escalated once again after NATO expelled some members of the Russian mission. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that the organization expelled the 8 Russian diplomats over a rise in, quote, malign activities by Moscow. The Russian government was quick to slam NATO's decision. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said that there is an obvious inconsistency in statements by NATO representatives about their desire to normalize relations with Russia and in their actual actions. He added that such actions allow Moscow not to develop illusions about the normalization of relations. Meanwhile, chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the lower house of the Russian parliament, Leonid Slutsky, warned of asymmetric retaliatory measures. How will this latest episode of tensions between the two sides play out? NATO's relations with Moscow have largely been tied to the policies of the United States. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was usually accused of being too soft on Russia, but Joe Biden has made it clear that his administration will be tough on Moscow. In his first 100 days in office, Biden imposed 2 new sets of sanctions on Moscow and expelled nearly a dozen Russian diplomats from the U.S. Biden has repeated accusations of interference in U.S. elections and cyber attacks on government and businesses against Russia. Washington and Moscow were also locked in a dispute over embassy staffing, which could further sour their ties. Analysts believe that the rivalry between the Russian Federation and the West, including NATO, is too deep-rooted to be solved in any foreseeable future.
The biggest ever data leak in history has exposed hidden offshore assets worth millions of dollars, allegedly tied to 35 current and former world leaders and more than 300 other public officials from over 90 countries. Nearly 3 terabytes of data, dubbed the Pandora Papers, were leaked to the Washington-based International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Over 600 journalists helped review 12 million documents leaked from 14 financial services companies. Jordan's King Abdullah, a close U.S. ally, was reported to have used offshore accounts to spend more than $100 million on luxury homes in the United Kingdom and the United States. The papers also accused the family and close associates of Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev of corruption, suggesting that they've traded close to £400 million in UK property over the past 15 years through a network of offshore firms. The papers have also implicated the Czech Prime Minister, presidents of Ukraine, Cyprus, Kenya, and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, among other high-profile figures.
Because people don't want to solve it. It's very simple. I mean, first of all, bear in mind the central banks around the globe have opened up their money spigots to extraordinary levels since the 2008 financial crisis. So as a result, you have tons and tons and tons of capital circulating around the world, unregulated, looking for the highest profit levels, etc. And the banking sectors are making lots and lots of money over this.
While having offshore firms and accounts isn't illegal, the papers allege that some of the companies have helped officials hide their wealth, practically enabling them to evade paying taxes, while some others have used them for money laundering and other fraudulent financial schemes. According to the Pandora Papers, over a dozen U.S. states are providing financial secrecy services that rival those of offshore tax havens in Europe and the Caribbean region. The documents single out South Dakota, which has allegedly sheltered billions of dollars in assets linked to people previously accused of financial crimes. The investigation says South Dakota state lawmakers have adopted lax regulations drafted by trust industry insiders, measures that have quadrupled customers' trust in the state compared to 10 years ago. Some of the trusts cited in the probe are linked to people accused of human rights and labor abuses. The revelations come despite President Joe Biden's pledge that Washington will lead the efforts internationally to promote financial transparency and fight against corruption.
Now, the U.S., for example, talks about equalizing tax rates, shutting down tax havens, et cetera, but in fact, individual U.S. states have been opening their doors wider and wider to these kinds of activities. South Dakota is one example, Nevada is another, and a third is Delaware, a small state on the East Coast, which is home to Joe Biden. And Joe Biden's history, he essentially is a product of this anything-goes, hot-money corporate culture.
The rich and powerful people cited in the large-scale investigation have already begun to deny wrongdoings and in some cases express readiness to undergo scrutiny. What's for certain is that they have a lot to answer for in their respective countries for the months or even years to come.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Emmet is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the book The Inner Voice, Allama Sayyid Said Akhtar Rizvi aptly explains the need for a man to understand his purpose in life and to be able to ponder over some of the important aspects of our journey in reaching nearness to Allah. Today, we will read to you an excerpt of this book. Stay with us. Love and fear of Allah. All praise is only for God, the Lord of Universe, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Master of the Day of Judgment, Quran chapter 1, verses 2 to 4. These are the very first verses of the Quran. They present in clear terms the concept of God in Islam. God is merciful and just. According to Islam, the divine justice is not separate from His mercy. The divine justice cannot be compared with the justice meted out by the judges in the courts. These judges are only the executors of the law, given to them by others with little or no authority to condone the culprits. They are bound by the law. They're helpless against the strict implications of law when it demands punishment. They cannot dispense mercy even if the culprit is repenting, even if the circumstances demand mercy. Petitions for mercy are addressed to the head of state, who is the supreme promulgator of law. But God is not a mere judge. He is the lawgiver and the supreme authority. Hence, an offender can be sure of his merciful pardon if his repentance be genuine. Islam puts the mercy of God before His justice. The very first verse of the Quran is, "In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful." Islam believes that His mercy is before His wrath. Thus, the Muslims have a finely balanced faith which is inclined neither to this side nor to that. It does not teach us that God is a high-handed avenger who does not forgive a single sin or mistake. But it does not present God in the shape of a feeble person who will not punish even the tyrannies and brutalities of headhunters. The essence of Islamic faith is in the above-mentioned verses, where the mercy of God has been mentioned side by side with His justice. Here we find a real divine religion which encourages man to go nearer to Allah, attracted by His mercy and grace, and warns him against trespassing the limits of moral and religious laws by reminding him that God is just, the master of the day of judgment. Thus, the two most important instincts of man, that is, love and fear, are simultaneously utilized to make man a perfect being, a whole being, not wanting in any respect. Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was an excerpt from the book Inner Voice by Allama Sayyid Said Akhtar Rizvi. Our website is parstoday.com. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
In the limelight. The social oppressed discovered a vocal minority in the United States tout their supplements as alternatives, donate large sums of money to anti-vaccine organizations, and sell anti-vaccine advertisements on Facebook and Instagram. We're prepared for you an article written jointly by Michelle R. Smith, Scott Bauer, and Mike Catalini. The piece is titled "Anti-Vaccine Chiropractors Capitalizing on COVID and Sowing Misinformation." The article has been published by the Associated Press. flashy postcard covered with images of syringes beckoned people to attend VaxCon 21 to learn the uncensored truth about COVID-19 vaccines. Participants traveled from around the country to a Wisconsin Dells resort for a sold-out convention that was, in fact, a sea of misinformation and conspiracy theories about vaccines and the pandemic. The featured speaker was the anti-vaccine activist who appeared in the 2020 movie Plandemic, which pushed false COVID-19 stories into the mainstream. One session after another discussed bogus claims about the dangers of wearing face masks and dangers of vaccines. The convention was organized by members of a profession in which a vocal minority seek disproportionate influence on COVID, chiropractors. At a time when the U.S. Surgeon General says misinformation has become an urgent public threat, public health threat in the United States, an investigation by the Associated Press found that a group of chiropractors capitalizing on the pandemic by sowing fear and mistrust of vaccines. The Associated Press discovered they have touted their supplements as alternatives to vaccines, written doctor's notes to allow patients to get out of wearing face masks and immunization mandates, donated large sums of money to anti-vaccine organizations, and sold anti-vaccine advertisements on Facebook and Instagram. One chiropractor gave thousands to a super PAC that hosted an anti-vaccine pro-Donald Trump rally near the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, D.C. on 6th of January. They've also been the leading force behind anti-vaccine events, like the one in Wisconsin, where hundreds of chiropractors shelled out $299 or more to attend the conference. Public health advocates in the United States have been alarmed. Erica DeWald of Vaccine Your Family, who tracks figures in the anti-vaccine movement, said people trust them. They trust their authority, but they also feel likely they're a nice alternative to traditional medicine. She added, mainstream medicine will refer people out to a chiropractor not knowing that they could be exposed to misinformation. You go because your back hurts, and then suddenly you don't want to vaccinate your kids. They represent a small but vocal minority of the nation's 70,000 chiropractors, many of whom advocate in favor of vaccines. In some places, chiropractors have helped organize vaccine clinics or been authorized to give COVID-19 vaccine shots. The pandemic gave a new platform to a faction of chiropractors who had been stirring up anti-vaccine misinformation long before COVID-19 arrived. Chiropractic was founded in 1895 by D.D. Palmer, a magnetic healer who argued that most disease was a result of misaligned vertebrae. Its early leaders rejected the use of surgery and the use of drugs, as well as the idea that germs cause disease. This led many to reject vaccines. A 2015 Gallup survey found an estimated 33.5 million adults had seen a chiropractor in the previous 12 months. The Associated Press found since 2019, chiropractors and chiropractor-backed groups have worked to influence vaccine-related legislation and policy in at least 24 states. For example, an organization started by a chiropractor and a co-owner of a chiropractic business takes credit for torpedoing a New Jersey bill in early 2020 that would have ended the state's religious exemption for vaccines. Then the pandemic hit, creating new avenues for profit. The first complaint the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, filed under the COVID-19 Consumer Protection Act was in April against a Missouri chiropractor. It charges he falsely advertised that vaccines do not stop the spread of the virus, but that supplements he sold for $24 per bottle plus $9.95 shipping costs did. He says he did not advertise his supplements that way and is fighting the allegations in a court of law. Nebraska chiropractor Ben Tapper landed on the Disinformation Dozen, a list compiled by the Center for Countering Digital Hate, which says he's among the small group of people responsible for nearly two-thirds of anti-vaccine content online. In his view, the public is being told that they need a vaccine to be healthy, which he doesn't believe is true. He said vaccines have no place in what he calls the wellness and prevention paradigm. It's unclear how widespread anti-vaccine sentiment is in the ranks of chiropractors, but there are some clues. Stephen Pearl, a professor at the University of Bridgeport School of Chiropractic, recently surveyed thousands of U.S. chiropractors. He said his and other surveys show that less than 20% of chiropractors have unorthodox views, such as opposition to vaccines. Stephen Pearl called the group an exceedingly vocal, engaged minority. Associated Press could find no national numbers of vaccination rates among chiropractors, but Oregon tracks vaccine uptake among all licensed health providers. Just 58% of licensed chiropractors and 55% of chiropractic assistants in Oregon were vaccinated as of 5th of September this year, compared with 96% of dentists, 92% of doctors, 83% of registered nurses, 68% of naturopathic physicians, and 75% of the general public. One chiropractor, for example, in North Carolina says people who get flu shots are poisoning themselves. A patient testimonial on the website of a chiropractor in Georgia proclaims, "Dr. Liu has taught me how toxic shots and vaccinations are." A Michigan chiropractor, Kyle McCammy, tells patients on a pediatric intake form, "If you would like information regarding the dangers of vaccines and how to refuse them, let us know." The line is punctuated by a smiley face emoji. On the west coast of the United States, a chiropractic seminar and expo called CalJam, run by chiropractor Billy DeBoss, said in 2019 it raised $500,000 for a group led by one of the world's most prominent anti-vaccine activists, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Another group, Stand for Health Freedom, was co-founded in 2019 by another member of the Disinformation Dozen, Sayed G, along with chiropractor Joel Bohemia and Leah Wilson, who co-owns a chiropractic business in Indiana with her chiropractor husband. The New Jersey Senate's Democratic President, Steve Sweeney, told Associated Press that he was concerned some chiropractors were running afoul of the state's truth and advertising laws because they were spreading anti-vaccine misinformation. He said, "Chiropractors are violating the law in giving medical advice, and the ones that are found to violate the law should have their licenses stripped from them." He added, "They're not medical doctors, and they're giving advice as if they're experts, and they're certainly not."
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Salam, the Islamic salutations. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Among the salutations of various nations, salam, the Islamic salutation and greeting, has a special luminosity because it indicates both welcoming and peace, pleasure and friendship, and also wish for peace from God for the other party. This is what salam holds in itself. When we say assalamu alaikum, or we say salamullah alayh, right, this is where we are implying all these things. It's a parcel and package. In today's world, though, we use it as just a way of greeting without paying too much attention towards the meaning of what we are saying. This is the most comprehensive way of greeting someone. Islam has provided it for us. For this reason, the salutation of people of paradise is salam. And angels of mercy receive the virtuous and good doers with salam. Unfortunately, some egoistic Muslims think that it's, you know, not saluting or not sending salutations or not being able to be the first one to salute someone or to send salutation reflects their high status, and saluting reduces their ranks. And we see this in our societies, right? That you don't really initiate salam. So many times we see, especially with the people who are arrogant, they wait for the other person to say salam, and then they decide whether they're going to respond to that person or not, and how good that response is going to be. Islam has promoted us and encouraged us to initiate in sending salam on the other person. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing one of the very ethical and moral trait of Islam, which is sending salutations and doing salam to other people, the Islamic salutations. Before the break, we were discussing how some people are so arrogant that they don't want to initiate salam, and even if somebody says salam to them, they are, you know, thinking about whether they're going to respond to them with a salam or not. This is un-Islamic and unacceptable. You know, by doing this, they deprive themselves of the great reward mentioned in the traditions of Islam, especially for those who show humility by taking the initiative to salute first and send salutations first. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the third infallible Imam, has said, salam or salutation has 70 rewards, 69 parts of which are for one who salutes, and one part of which is for one who returns the salutation. So if you initiate the salam, and if you are the first one to say salamun alaikum, then you are getting 69 rewards, as compared to only one reward that you get when you respond to a salam. As we know that in Islamic jurisprudence, saying salam is mustahab, which is recommended, and responding to a salam is wajib, which is obligatory. So try to be the first one to initiate the salam, whether it to be the elders or your age mates or even the youngers. Prophet Muhammad and Ahlul Bayt wasalam, they used to try their level best to initiate salam, even with the youth, the younger ones. So we need to get into habit of sending Islamic salutations on our mu'min and believer brothers and sisters. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.